Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today, a hugely acclaimed and often controversial writer of novels, stories and stage and screenplays, defined a generation with his seminal debut novel, Trainspotting, in 1993. He's written 15 books, four of which are collections of short stories, two plays and nine screenplays. From Scotland originally, he now lives in Chicago. Irvin Welsh, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you for having me.
So your new book, The Blade Artist, takes the most terrifying character from Trainspotting, that's Francis Begbie, and casts him as the protagonist in a thriller. In the book, we get some sense of Begbie's early life, including his crippling dyslexia. And I know that you too have a form of dyslexia. And I wondered how that affected your childhood and your academic career.
It's funny because often when you're dyslexic, you kind of you seem to be slow, you know, and slowness is kind of seen as being thick, basically, as seen as being stupid. It's actually not slow; it's the reverse of that. Sometimes it's you're actually too quick, you know. I found it very hard to focus on one line without moving on to the next. I wanted to actually, my kind of brain was forming these patterns. It was almost like kind of summarizing the whole thing. I wanted to almost get the key salient points and kind of summarize it without actually having read the whole thing. So that was the thing, you know, that to me, I just had to kind of slow down and take my time to read. And it's actually been good for me in terms of writing, because it means that I can take time to process things, and I can kind of, I can try and slow my thoughts down as I write a sentence and sort of, you know, and think about what it actually means.
Mm-hmm. I know that you started writing songs. Was that in a way to help with your dyslexia, to put words to music?
Not really. It was just really being fascinated by sound and by music and by lyrics and by the all the great sort of musicians that I loved, and it was kind of trying to emulate them in a way that you do when you have heroes. You know, they're the kind of heroes that you have. It's not really literary heroes, it's kind of sort of musical, it's music heroes, basically. So you want to emulate them first. When you realise you don't have that musical talent, you know, it's like, I was always writing stories, I was always writing ballads. Whenever I wrote a song, it was telling a story. And I thought, well, you're no good at the music, but the writing side, the lyrical side of it, there seems to be something there. It seems to be what your real orientation is towards. So it was like kind of making a kind of virtue out of necessity, in a way.
But you were quite good at music. You joined two bands. You had a hit single, didn't you?
Well, what happened was that the hit single was with Primal Scream, so it doesn't really count. It was their hit single, and I was just kind of coattailing with some lyrics on top of it. But what happened is, whenever I got into working with people doing music, as soon as they got good, I would be the first one that would be kicked out, basically. It's a collaborative thing, and if you join with a bunch of pals and you can't progress at the same rate as them, you're going to go, basically. You know, and once that happens a few times, the kind of writing's on the wall.
Music is very strong in your work, though. It kind of pulses through your work. And I wonder if you can listen while you're writing and if what you listen to affects the way that you write.
Yeah, I mean, I make a playlist up for every character, and that's why, you know, I think, who is this character? And I think, what will they listen to? And I make the playlist up, and I listen to the playlist, and I get a greater sense of the character. And the more detail that I get on the character, the more the character writes a story, you know. So it's part of the composition process for me. When I started out writing, I was going to clubs. I was obsessed by acid house and dance music. I was DJing. And I wanted to kind of replicate in literature on the page that kind of energy that you felt when you went into a house music club. So I wanted the 4/4 beat, basically, and using the Scottish vernacular, which is more of a kind of performative, kind of funky kind of sort of language than standard English, which is more of a descriptive language. That was my way of kind of trying to emulate that 4/4 beat, you know, and all the typographical experiments that I did, you know, with, you know, sort of enlarging words falling off a page, kind of different fonts and all sorts of kind of weird typographical stuff. You know, a couple of novels I did filled Barbie Stork Nightmares, The Acid House, I had all this kind of weird things happening on the page. These were my effects kind of on top of the 4/4 beat, really. So I was actually not just emotionally influenced by music, like I think a lot of writers are and have to be, but also structurally kind of influenced by it. I was trying to actually compose with a view to recreating that kind of energy.
Mm. And does that whole club scene and that kind of music still resonate with you, or have you moved on?
It does in a way. I mean, it becomes part of your emotional vocabulary and it becomes part of who you are, but in a very practical sense, it's like kind of these legs no longer can pull all-nighters, basically, without me stuffing all kinds of drugs into my throat, and I can't do that anymore. You know, I'm not really interested in doing that because I just lie in bed the next day feeling sorry for myself. And also these things, intoxicants don't hit you in the same way as you're older. You know, you just think, this just makes me feel tired and fed up. You know, I'm not getting that real buzz. And I'm going to talk the same stuff that I've talked a million times when I'm in this state. So you don't really do that. And you tend to sort of, you're still drawing it as a kind of reservoir of sort of, you know, learned kind of responses. But you kind of tend to sort of get your influences from other means, basically.
When did you first encounter drugs then?
Me, I think it's, you know, I don't think you ever disencounter drugs. They're so much a part of our culture. I mean, we're in an increasing drug culture. I mean, I think that we're going to be in an even greater drug culture as the world of work collapses. You know, it's like the world of paid work collapses and drugs always fill the gap. I mean, drugs are become the compelling drama, basically, that we used to have from offices and factories. Mm-hmm. You know, we now have it on the streets with kind of drug deals and drug transactions. So I think that you know, it's part of the transition of our society from, you know, capitalism to conceptualism, basically, to a world without paid work, to a world with where we're making kind of intellectual goods rather than physical goods. We're manufacturing information, you know, so that doesn't really pay, you know. So it's like we spend so much time in psychic space. So drugs are going to fill that kind of social gap, basically. They're almost like the Black Death was when we moved from feudalism to capitalism. They're the new plague. They're the new plague that's accompanying us from capitalism into conceptualism.
So what will happen after drugs then, post-drugs?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think that, you know, you look at where we're going and it just becomes science fiction now, you know. It's like artificial intelligence, you know, big data are going to continue to destroy jobs. More middle-class jobs, kind of, you know, medicine, sort of law, they're all going to go. And what do we do? We ask that existential question. What do we do as human beings? Do we continue to survive as kind of carbon-based life forms on a poisoned planet, or do we kind of interface with silicon-based life forms and machines? Or if we made ourselves redundant, you know, do we just kind of let the machines kill us and sort of fly off, and then they fly off into space and colonize the rest of the galaxy? You know, is that the next stage? Nobody knows. And because nobody knows and everybody's insecure about it, what we do is we turn to kind of silly loudmouthed demagogues who seem to have simple answers and to all these complex questions.
Mm. I sense a science fiction novel in the
Well, it's science fiction reality. It's amazing. It's like kind of I used to sort of disdain all this kind of stuff, and then now, you know, science fiction is just creeping up on us so quickly.
Mm. You, though, got yourself off drugs. Was there a moment that you can point to when everything changed for you?
Not really, no. I mean, I just kind of think that, you know, you don't really make a conscious sort of decision to get on drugs. They just kind of take over in the absence of anything else, and you have to kind of, you get to a point in your life and you think, well, what am I actually doing here? This is not really what I want to be doing. I mean, I'm kind of, I'm working too hard to do this and it's not giving me any return. So you get to that point, you think, well, why? I think it's very, very hard to stay on drugs. It's a lot of people who have done it for years and years and years, and I admire them, you know, because I don't have that tenacity. I don't have that kind of willpower or determination, you know. To me, it's a lot easier just to stop. When I was on heroin, I found that I couldn't really do anything. It's a very kind of apathy-inducing sort of lifestyle. You know, you just want to sit and look at walls, basically, until you kind of, until you get sick and need to go out and kind of do stuff. But it was like, the only thing I could do was I could do these doodles in this notebook. And I thought that I was writing about some scenes and about people I met and things I'd done, but I realised that another kind of characteristic of that life is the kind of lies that you have to tell to yourself in order to perpetuate it. And I realised that all these little stories and little scenarios, they had one thing in common. They were kind of very incredibly self-aggrandising towards me, you know, and incredibly kind of scornful about everybody else and all that. And I thought, there's something in here, but you know, I'm almost a writer, but I'm not quite a writer. And I think that I had the kind of the necessary but not sufficient thing to make me a writer. And it took me a while to find out, you know. And the first thing is obviously that egotism, that kind of rampant egotism that you have to believe that your story is worth telling. And it took me a long time to find out what the second thing was, to get to that, to get past all that.
And what was the second thing?
Well, the second thing is just kind of getting beyond yourself, you know, and it's like getting past yourself. And instead of all that introspective self-justification and looking inwards, I mean, use that as a launch pad, yes, but the next point is to look outwards and to develop empathy and to start looking at the rest of the world and to mitigate everything that you feel in your own prejudices by an observation of what's going on around you and an observation of what other people are looking at and what they're interested in and starting to learn from them and starting to think about where they're coming from and what they're doing and what's motivating them. And I think that getting past myself and looking outwards was a terrific thing for me, you know, both as a person and as a writer.
You write fiction, but of course based on a lot of people that you knew, the places that you'd go to, the drug experiences that you had. What do those people who were around you at the time think now? Do they celebrate your success?
Well, it's very difficult to kind of, you know, to know what other people are thinking, basically. You know what I mean? You can only infer. And what I've found is that my old friends, the people that I've grown up with, you know, close friends, family, have really been incredibly kind and generous and supportive, and probably a lot more than I would have been if I'd been. If, you know, it's like I'm amazed by the lack of hostility or snidiness or kind of that I've had, you know, from people that I've been very close to. And by the community in general, I felt incredibly supported by my home city, by Edinburgh, by, you know, by Leith, by Muirhouse, by the places that I grew up in. And I shouldn't say I've been surprised by it, because, you know, you grew up with great people and all that, and, you know, they are good people. But also, people have a lot of kind of things going on in their life. They have a lot of, you know, they've got the struggle to pay red bills and all that. And you would think that some people would, you know, would manifest a kind of jealousy or hostility and all that, if somebody else is, see, you know, is close to them as successful. But I've never felt that vibe at all, you know, and that's in about 30 years. So I've been really, I don't know if I've been really lucky or if just people have been exceptionally nice that I've grown up with.
You're defined as a Scottish writer, but of course you've lived all over the world. You've been in Ireland, you've been in Amsterdam, and finally Chicago.
Yeah. I mean, I've kind of never had any game plan, really. I mean, I've just, it's been sort of opportunistic. I always wanted to, I feel a bit disappointed that I've not travelled more. You know, I've always wanted to live, you know, if I had my way, I would live for 2 years in one place and then move on. I would just continually do that. And it mitigates against a stable life and relationships and kind of all that sort of stuff. So you kind of make that compromise. And when you get really into a place and you get really friendly with people, there's a kind of sadness when you leave it as well, you know. And even though you've got that nice fresh slate of going somewhere else, I'd like to think I've got a couple more moves left in me, but I've got my feet under the table a little bit in Chicago now.
And so being away from Scotland and observing it from afar, I wonder what changes you've perceived. And I suppose this is going back into your neoliberalism argument, perhaps.
I think there's a lot more confidence in the country now. I mean, Scotland was kind of, it feels like a place now. It feels like an actual discrete place. It always felt like something that was kind of a bit depressed and aspiring to be a place. Now it feels a bit more confident. It feels like this is who we are. This is our place. This is a different, you know, we're a kind of discrete entity in a way. We've kind of realised who we are and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's a bit more, it's healthier. You know, I think, I notice a difference between the younger generations and the older generations. The older generations seem a little bit kind of depressed and a bit anxious, and the younger generations seem very kind of confident. And if not, you know, young people don't really have a lot to be optimistic and confident about, you know, the way the society and the economy is going. But I notice that a lot of younger people in Scotland seem to be nicer to each other than, say, my generation was. We always like strangers, when but we're often a bit superficially harsh and aggressive with each other. I mean, I notice when there's something like when I go, you know, if I'm in Chicago and I meet somebody in a bar that's Scottish, normally if I heard another Scottish accent, you know, years and years ago, I would run a mile and go, I don't want to talk to this guy, there's another Scot in the bar. No. It's almost like that thing that you don't want anybody to be more Scottish than you. But I think to me that is a, that's a kind of lack of confidence. It's a sort of lack, you know, it's like this kind of assertion of that is something to do with a sort of lack of confidence. And that's not the case now. You know, if I hear somebody that's Scottish in a bar, I'll just chat to them, but it's not a big thing. You know, it's not like, oh, you're Scottish, where are you from? It's just like, hey, how are you doing? And all, you know. So it's like if you met somebody from Poland or you met somebody from England or Spain or something like that, there's not a, you know, it's just, you just crack on in that same way. So there is that much more relaxed acceptance, you know, of this is where we're at in this point in time. But I think there's been a definite progression.
You wrote once, though, that Scotland ruled by effete arseholes, talking of England. Would you be in favour of independence?
Well, I think it's something that's, to me, it's just something that's a secular result of the decline of Britishness. It's, I think Brexit is to some extent as well with England. I mean, I think it's like, you know, when you think about Britain was formed by industry and empire and it was sustained by the esprit de corps of two world wars and it was built by a kind of post-war welfare state and the great nationalised industries, you know, steel, coal, rail. You know, and it was sustained by a kind of regional policy which made Britain into a very homogenous sort of country. That's all gone, basically. That's all been undermined. So everything that constituted Britain no longer exists. And the only part of Britain that does exist is the old imperialist Britain, the old pre-war idea of imperialist Britain, kind of royalty, aristocracy, privilege, kind of, you know, the House of Lords and sort of that sense of Britishness, that kind of, you know, inclusive Commonwealth, kind of sort of old-school BBC, kind of post-war consensus sense of Britain is all gone. Mm. You know, it's just that it's kind of been destroyed by 30 years of neoliberalism, which both parties have brought into. And I think, you know, because of that, I think that you've seen the countries in Britain almost reverting to their constituent kind of pre-imperial sort of ideas. You know, it's like Scotland almost has this kind of, you know, this fascination that, that you know, that it had before the empire, this fascination with trade and being part of a sort of, you know, a social democratic part of a whole European whole. England, it's this kind of, you know, it's back to the almost this, like, conquest idea of foreigners are to be a bit distrusted and we kind of have to keep our distance from them. And I think that, you know, the interesting thing to me is, like, Scotland's had this, since the devolution debate in 79, it's had this chance to redefine itself in a way and to say, you know, who are we, and ask these existential questions. I think the interesting thing about Brexit is done, it's given England that opportunity as well. You know, it's, are we this multi-ethnic, multicultural kind of nation that's part of this sort of European social democratic project? Or are we a kind of old school, imperialistic, very individualistic, exceptionalist nation? You know, so so this is a debate that I think England is having now, you know.
Yeah.
And I think this is why Scotland will leave. And I think this is why kind of Northern Ireland possibly will as well, because they're not really helping England. You know, they're not really helping by, you know, sustaining this kind of great British UK imperialist delusion. They're not really helping this debate sort of be realised. And it's essentially an English debate.
Brexit and the coming of Trump are often compared to each other. And I wondered if we could take that a step further and ask whether, if in your eyes, there's a parallel between the race politics of Chicago and the mood in Scotland.
It would be stretching it a bit. I mean, I think that, you know, that all various groups, you know, of people kind of who are alienated and kind of and have different levels of dispossession from the democratic processes, which is practically everybody nowadays, like, you know, they all have various axes to grind and they all have various ways of engaging with that, you know. So I think with the race politics of Chicago are kind of... to me, it goes right back to slavery and transportation and the Civil War, and it's something that America hasn't resolved. You know, it's not resolved that. I mean, when I moved to America, I was really, really surprised about how it felt physically like apartheid in South Africa, and still does. You know, how people, apart from very few, almost like trendy enclaves, how racially segregated it is. You know, how, you know, and much more so than England, for example. It's like kind of how you don't have black people and white people living in the same neighbourhoods. You don't have black people and Hispanic people and white people living in the same neighbourhoods. And to me, that just seems really so strange. where you live, you know, has to be defined by ethnicity. It just seems daft.
Mm. That difference between different sides of the Atlantic, you write a wonderful section about how the currency of beauty is defined differently in Britain and America.
I can't actually remember what that section is, but I mean, I don't remember much about the books, but I think, you know, there is, you know, there are differences. And I think one of the things, the great things about living abroad is that you see how weird your own place is, where you come from is. You think you come from a very mundane place and everywhere else is interesting. But in reality, you know, it's like where you come from is usually the most exotic place on earth. It's, you know, you, when you actually see all our strange foibles, it's bizarre.
Mm. You were talking about dialogue earlier and writing in the Scottish vernacular. And there's such a wonderful line in The Blade Artist where Jim feels his accent bland out, which I just love the idea of him kind of suddenly just becoming, you know, nothing. And you were talking about earlier writing it to kind of try and capture that club feel.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is. And I think, you know, your accent kind of does bland out, you know. It's like you can't really help it. You know, I try not to, and it's like if I go into a bar and say like my wife doesn't understand me, it's not a chat up line, it's an actual kind of description of real life, you know.
Because
I can
she's
get
American
off. Yeah, when we get off at Edinburgh Airport and we get into the taxi, as soon as I'm in the taxi and start talking to the taxi driver, you know, she just says, what are you doing? I just don't get this at all. But you know, in order to be understood, you know, you just do bland out. You know, you just feel your, you know, you get into all that very slow kind of transatlantic talk, and it's like, you know, it's horrible. You know, but
you talk about your wife, and Jim has completely reinvented himself in California in The Blade Artist, including having a new family, and he also talks about being rendered soft by loving. Mel, his wife, is his tender underbelly. Does love make you vulnerable?
No, I think love makes you strong. I think love and art are the great things that we strive to. And this is what our whole life is about, basically. I mean, this is the compensation that we have for our mortality. You know, we've got to find love. We've got to express ourselves. You know, and these are the most important things in life. And I think we're rendered obsolete by not pursuing these things, basically, or being kind of too repressed or too messed up within ourselves to actually reach out for these things that are around us. So yeah, I mean, that's going back to the big existential challenges. That's what we're here for, basically. We're here to try and kind of get past all the crap that stops us from kind of from falling in love, from expressing ourselves by, you know, kind of writing and painting and sort of in sport too, you know, by kind of abseiling off cliffs and stuff.
Mm. I mean, Jim Begbie is accused of being emotionless, but he points out, of course, anger is an emotion.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, He's a very emotional guy in a lot of ways, and he's been kind of socialised and conditioned through his background into expressing it in a very kind of violent way, you know. And he's trying through his art not to do that, but he's almost gone past that point. You know, his visceral buzz is towards violence, and he can't stop that. So what he's done is he's been much more calculating about it, and he's managed to change that kind of indiscriminate sort of hot-blooded violence into very cold-blooded violence, and generally against people who he has that egotistical need to crush, which is really other violent men. Mm-hmm. And a lot of men who are violent is that kind of thing. It's a need to come up against someone else who's violent.
Why choose him? Why expand that character in particular?
Oh, it was kind of an accident. I mean, the character was dead to me. He just didn't have anywhere to go. You know, I mean, he was like, he was either going to end up in the jail or he was going to end up dead, you know, and there's no drama. There's no drama to be had from any of that. And I got asked by The Big Issue to do a story about him, a Christmas story, and I decided, because I'd done a Big Issue Christmas story before, I thought I'll do one about him, but it might be interesting if he's the most, the nicest guy in the room instead of the biggest nutter in the room, make him the most reasonable guy. And I thought, well, how do I do that, you know? And again, going back to love and art, I mean, these were the only things, ways I could think about how he could possibly be redeemed. And that was it. And then, when, you know, the book, you know, came about by me basically working with John Hodge and Danny Boyle and Andrew McDonald again, you know, and thinking about, can we do T2? Can we do porno as a movie? And I got back into the character and I thought, well, what if he's only pretending to to be this reformed character, and he's just got control of his emotions, but he's still incredibly violent, still wants to do the same things. That might may be interesting, and the book kind of came out of that, really.
Mm. I mean, do you think that we can always have? I mean, how? I suppose that's maybe the central question in the book is how much control do we really have, and how much control does he really have, and is he then a victim or a monster?
I think, in a way, he's both, and I think you kind of. You have to get a grip of yourself, basically. You kind of, just by kind of taking a step back, you do give yourself options. You're not responding to everything that goes on around you, and that's the sort of, that's the kind of biggest challenge for people who are quite impulsive, and people who are kind of impulsive or compulsive, obsessive or addictive or whatever, is to take that beat and to stand back and to look at what you're doing and where this is going.
I wonder if your approach to this book was different, given that it's a thriller.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that it was a bit different. I mean, a lot of it is in third person, for example, because, one, I didn't want to reveal too much about what was in his head. I wanted to keep him a bit of a mystery and an enigma going through the book. And also, if you do that, you can turn the pages quite quickly. You can bang, 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 bang. It's like you're kind of... But also, I didn't want to spend too much time in his head myself. It's like you get... when you start to create characters that are a bit damaged and a bit out there, it's not really good for you to spend a lot of time kind of in their heads, writing in first person.
It affects your life.
When I wrote Marabou's Thought Nightmares, it was a very dark book, and it was like narrated by a very messed up character. And I knew this would happen because I knew the subject matter was going to be very dark. I felt I had to write it in first person, but I didn't want to because of the immediacy, sort of it. And it was kind of... So I wrote it over a month, basically. I finished it in a month and I got it out of the way very quickly. And then I wrote Filth, which was, again, another very dark character, and I wrote that largely in the first person. And I thought, it went on for too long, a very, very long time, and it kind of, it did kind of affect me. I was kind of, and I thought, nah, I don't want to do that again. If I write a very dark character, I'm going to write them in short bursts. I'm going to write them largely in third person.
The violence is so explicit and it seems so accurate. And I wonder how you plan the anatomy of that, the way the blood arcs or a blade slips in.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like trial and error. You write something like that and you see if it reads right. Does it seem right? And that stuff is fairly easy to research, that kind of thing. But it's... You want something that seems very, that feels very accurate, and it feels very much... The character's, he's a sociopath, I suppose you would say, but anybody who's like that has got to be very kind of... got to have an element of coldness to do that to another human being. So you have to see it through their eyes in a very kind of detached way.
I wonder if you think a writer must have a sense of moral responsibility.
I think the actual art form, if you like, imposes that on you. I think it's very, very hard to be a novelist, I think, and write with bad intentions. Evil, malevolent psychopaths have got, they don't really have the attention span to write a novel. They don't have the empathy to write a novel. But I think it's very, very hard to write a novel with bad intentions. I think it's very hard to write a book with bad intentions, because it's such a long exercise. And the good thing about evil and good is that they're kind of fleeting emotions, really. They're just fleeting states. Most of the time we're kind of neutral, we might think of ourselves as good, but how much good do we really do? We do duty, basically. Mm-hmm. We go through life and kind of, we do what we think is right, but it's basically what other people think is right. We go off in this trajectory. Sometimes we'll do some unsolicited acts of kindness. Sometimes under pressure we'll do something stupid or, that seems to be malevolent or kind of lashing out nasty. But these states are very, very fleeting. To write something that's just pure nasty malevolence, why would you want to write a book if there's no intrinsic desire to kind of make the world a better place? Mm. It's a long, long time to spend trying to do something just to make the world worse.
And you always do seem to have that redemption in your books.
If you have dark characters, people will put up with darkness, provided they're kind of struggling for the light switch. You've got to see them trying to get to the light switch. Mm. And people will put up with a lot if they believe that if you show enough humanity in the character to suggest other lives they might have had if they'd taken different options and to present different potential options for them, different possible escape routes. People are quite forgiving. It's like this character is like, he's having a bad year or a bad month, you know, he's having like kind of mental breakdown, or she's having, you know, divorce traumas, or, you know, they're having some kind of drug issues and all that, you know. But it's like they're not going to be like that all the time. Especially if they're younger, they're going to have some kind of consciousness. Or if it's somebody that's, you know, it's like a middle-aged character, it's like, you know, they're having some kind of midlife crisis. They'll settle down at some point, even though they've kind of, they might have ruined their life, basically.
Well, you've certainly enhanced all of our lives with your work. Thank you so much for coming on, Irvin Welsh.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The Blade Artist by Irvin Welsh is out now. It's published by Vintage. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Claire Urban and Tom Furze. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.